The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with the all-new Kia Ceed Sports Wagon. Space and style combine. Kia, home of the 7-year warranty.
And that single, When a Child is Born, is on sale from today. It can be downloaded from iTunes for €1.29, as can the album. Merry Christmas, downloaded from iTunes at €9.99. Sinead mentioned our concert, which is on in St Anne's Church on the 12th. That, unfortunately, is sold out, completely sold out. But we are going to broadcast highlights at this time on Wednesday, the 19th of December. So that's something to look forward to. Now, when you think of retirees taking to the sea, you probably think of cruise liners. But that wasn't the route taken by my next guest. Retired Church of Ireland clergyman Patrick Semple decided to travel the seven seas on cargo vessels, travelling with everything from bananas to buses. Patrick, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Shane.
You've survived the buses and the bananas.
We survived it very well, thank you.
Before we get to your exotic travels, where are you from originally?
I was born and brought up in Wexford Town, in the very last year of the 30s, and it was into the little 5% minority Church of Ireland community I was born. And then I went to boarding school in Dublin at the age of 11, and more or less have been in and around Dublin on and off since then. But I was ordained in the Church of Ireland in 1967, and I served three-year curacy in Belfast. After that, I went to University of Chicago for a year. And we'll come back to that because that's significant to do with the cargo ships.
Okay.
And when I came back, I was 11 years in Stradbally, County Laois, famous nowadays for Electric Picnic.
And the Steam Rally.
Famous then for the Steam Rally, exactly. After that, I was 6 years at our theological college in Rathgar. And after that, I was 8 years in Dinard and Dunleavin in West Wicklow, really the foot of the Glen of Imaal. And then finally, my last posting was to a very small parish, just off O'Connell Street, St. George and St. Thomas. But with it, the significant thing about that parish was that with it went the chaplaincies to Mountjoy Prison, the two Mater hospitals, public and private, and Temple Street. So it was a full-time job between all of those bits.
And that church is quite significant. You'll know it if it's beside the Calabrew Street College. It's almost in the middle of the road.
Correct. The road actually divides around it.
Yes.
One side is now closed off, but that's the way it was.
And did someone ask you to take on that chaplaincy, or are you sent to there to take on two hospitals, the Mater, private and public, Temple Street and Mountjoy?
Well, what happened was I always found myself after a reasonable length of time in a parish or a situation that I'd run out of originality, if you like, and I was ready for a change of scene. So after I'd been in West Wicklow for 8 years, I contacted the authorities and said, I'd like a move. And this came up and I was offered it and I was glad to take it.
And you're married and you've got two children, is that right?
I have, Ben and Sarah.
They're a little bit grown up now.
They're just about 40 and 38, I think.
What was it like for them moving around?
Well, to be honest with you, I suppose we didn't consult them. But I suppose young children just take it as natural that they go. I really ought to ask them that now that you've given rise to it.
Yeah, next time. It's a bit late now because they're their own children, of course.
That's right. They have children of their own.
That, to go into that, had you been to prisons before you were put into that ministry?
When I was in Stradbally, I had a couple of occasions as assistant chaplain to relieve the chaplain, to go into Port Laois prison. Okay. And when I was a curate in Belfast, I had to go and see, well, I didn't have to, but I went to see some prisoners who had been in our youth club. So I had two short visits to two prisons, yes.
I suppose, based on the Protestant population as a percentage of the entire population, you would imagine it's very small. You would imagine that the prison population as well of Protestants would be very small. Was that the case?
Absolutely the case. I mean, people used to say to me, are there many Church of Ireland people in Mountjoy? And I think in 2.5 years, I probably saw two, possibly three, as far as I can remember, Church of Ireland people. The rest of the prisoners that I had dealings with were mainly from abroad, Anglicans from abroad, a lot of them caught bringing in drugs and here for various other reasons, Nigeria, Australia, England. So they were mainly Anglicans from other countries.
And how were you treated as the chaplain? I mean, the chaplain holds a special place in prison.
I was treated wonderfully well. I worked extremely closely with the Catholic chaplains. There were three or four of them full-time, whereas I was part-time. But they were absolutely terrific to me. They incorporated me into everything. They helped me. They helped me to acclimatise to it. They were terrific, and I have very warm memories for those people. They were absolutely wonderful.
Tell us about some of the people you met there.
In prison, I met a lot of interesting kind of people. I suppose, for instance, I met an English man who had been part of the Cray gang in London. Now, maybe a minor part, I really don't know. He was a very nice guy. He was very funny. I used to see him once a week, and he told me that when he got out, his ambition was to start a women's football team. So I'm not sure what he had in mind, but I have no idea whether he did or not, because he was still in prison. And he wrote me a lovely letter. Some of the prisoners wrote me lovely letters when I retired. I actually retired on ill health. It was stress, really. And I'm fine, I mean, since, no problems. But some of the prisoners wrote me lovely letters when I retired, and he was one of them.
Is it difficult to, you meet all sorts of, and people are in jail for all sorts of reasons for, yeah. And we've seen that lately in the news as well, for what they call white-collar crime,
yeah.
And also for violent crimes, for murder, mm-hmm. for rape, and difficult things like that. How do you deal with those people? Do you know what they're in for? Do you have a look at their file first and then deal with them, or do you just take them as you find them?
Largely speaking, I used to take them as I found them. I dealt with them as people who were in a very difficult situation. And usually they would tell me, I would not ask ever, what are you in for? But they would almost always tell you. And the interesting thing is, I never met a prisoner who told me he shouldn't have been there. Isn't that interesting? All of them seemed to accept that they should have been there, that they were guilty, in other words. Now, some of them did say that their sentences were too long. And I had one prisoner who was in for having drugs in his house that weren't his. And he got, I think, 3 years. But when he appealed, he was released by the Court of Appeal immediately.
Right.
He didn't even come back to the prison. And that was absolutely right. He was a lovely guy. And
What do you think the benefit of having a chaplain in prison is for the prisoners and for their rehabilitation as well?
Well, you see, a chaplain has no involvement in the administration of the prison and of the way the thing works. You are entirely a neutral person. And very often you dealt with, they asked you to contact their families. And so you were in touch with their families as well. Even in England, I was in touch with a number of families. Now, the whole spiritual thing, yes, some of them did. I had some young prisoners that asked to be prepared for confirmation, and I did. And the Archbishop came into the prison to do a confirmation service in the little chapel where I had Sunday services. And one girl who was a friend of one of these mules caught bringing in drugs, she was a very low-risk prisoner, and the chief officer in the women's prison said, oh, she can go out to be confirmed and with an officer in Mufti. And it was a lovely occasion. And that particular young lady studied for subjects in the leaving and stayed on in prison some weeks, longer than she needed to, in order to sit her exams. Interesting.
What did you get out of it, Patrick? What did you...
I just met such wonderful people, such interesting people. And I suppose the satisfaction of being able to support them. I mean, I would make phone calls for them. And I suppose I can confess on air now. I had a phone in my office, in my little office, that I wasn't supposed to... But I used to quietly, off the record, allow prisoners to phone their wives and things.
Which was
against the rules, but yeah. I had no difficulty doing it.
And were you worried about being manipulated by prisoners? Or
I would have been very conscious of that, yes. I would have been aware and not allowed myself to be manipulated in any way. But most of them were, I just found them very interesting people, and I felt terribly sorry that they were in this situation.
So they give you Mountjoy, mm-hmm. and they give you three hospitals to
that's
deal
right,
with as well.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with children in Temple Street.
That's
so you
right.
go from Mountjoy
right.
to Temple Street. So
that's absolutely
tell us
right.
a little bit about your time in Temple Street.
Well, Temple Street, we didn't have that many in Church of Ireland, but I found that extremely difficult going through children's wards and seeing kids in terrible condition, terrible states of...
From my own experience in children's hospitals with my own children, it doesn't really matter about the denomination of the chaplain.
Not at all. And by the way, the same thing was the case in Mountjoy. Some Catholic prisoners would stop me, because I always wore the collar, say, can I come to your service on Sunday? I said, everybody's welcome. And at the beginning, I used to say to the Catholic chaplains, you know, one of the... They said, don't bother even telling us. If they're going to you, that's fine with us.
Yeah. But since we have them for God.
Yeah, that's at least. in the hospital, yes, the denominational thing just does not exist virtually.
And you backed each other up.
Absolutely. The chaplaincy departments are very supportive of each other, yes.
So you would have had to deal with some difficult nights there, I'm assuming.
Yes, and you, only once or twice over 2.5 years I was called out in the small hours. And then you're largely... supporting the family.
Yes. Your faith, if we can use that term, began to waver. Would that be the right thing to say? As you headed towards, I suppose, headed towards retirement as well. I mean, when you made it to that church and that parish, how was your faith at that stage?
Well, I was always a sceptic and skeptical. You know, they say that we all have a prototype in the gospel. Well, certainly Thomas was my prototype, if you like. And I always operated on the principle that the corollary of faith is doubt, that if you haven't got some doubt, you really don't have faith. And I mean, Christ on the cross himself doubted, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And so on. And when I was in college, I used to find myself in lectures wanting to ask asking questions. I actually stopped doing it, because I could hear in the silence that my colleagues saying, oh, God, there he goes again, you know. But then I got into the ministry, and I just loved the work, and I loved being with people, and I loved helping to create community. And this doubt thing would surface every now and again, and I'd consider leaving and so on, and then it would pass.
When was the first time you considered leaving?
I was in Stradbally, and at one stage I was going through a serious period of doubt. I actually sent away for the what was then known as the Personnel Management Institute, is now called HR, syllabus, to see if I would do that as maybe a way to leave. But then it passed, you see. And
did you tell anybody about it? Did you seek counsel? Did you speak to the bishop?
Well, what happened in towards the end was about a year before I left West Wicklow, that was about 3.5 years, I really felt I had to tell my bishop what I believed and didn't believe in conscience. So I made an appointment with him and I went to see him. And I told him straight, I didn't believe in this, that and the other of the faith, you know, divinity of Christ, resurrection.
Just a few basics.
A few very basics, very basics, exactly. And he was terrific. It was Donald Caird was the Archbishop at the time.
Yes.
And a very bright man and a man interested in theology and philosophy. He was a very good, and we had a long discussion. At the end of it, he said, get back to work. I think he felt this was another phase and I'd come through it. And in fact, that didn't happen. I then moved to Dublin to the job we were talking about. And I found that this thing was cropping up quite seriously in my mind. I did retire on the face of it on health grounds, but I was glad to retire.
So the stress was building up as well.
Yeah, it was.
And that was adding to it, as well as the jobs you were doing.
Exactly, yes. But then when I retired, it gave me time for reading in a way that I had, you know, postponed in the busy life of the ministry. And I read voraciously for 2 or 3 years. At the end, during that time, at the end of about 3 years, I was clear in my mind that I was an atheist. I believed there is no God. Simple as that. I doubted if there was. That'd be agnostic.
But if, when that was communicated back to the people that you had ministered, mm-hmm. you know, and somebody who's been on a premarital course mm-hmm. myself and, you know, confirmation and communion, I would feel a little bit betrayed.
Let down.
Let down, definitely.
I'm very sorry about that for people, and I really am, because... But my experience in during the ministry is that people who have a faith, a working, strong faith, they are not ultimately disturbed by doubt or by people who don't believe. They will hold on and continue and work through their faith in their own way. And if it has been offensive to anybody, and I'm sure it has somewhere, I'm sorry about that, but I had to do what I had to do for me. And that's where I would stand on that.
So you left the faith. You went. How do you resign from being a minister?
Well, there's no specific. I mean, there is a theological position which says once a priest, always a priest.
You don't send the collar back in an envelope to the bishop and say, no, that's it, I'm done.
No. But you see, I was retired at that stage.
Okay.
And it's simply a matter that my colleagues and the bishops would know that I'm outside the church now. And so I don't do any relief duty as a lot of retired people help in parishes and so on.
You'd always been interested in writing, obviously reading as well, but writing, and you have quite a few books under your belt.
Yes, and I don't really know how that began. When I was at the Theological College on the staff there, I sat down one day, I came up from lunch to my office, and just out of the blue, for some reason, I wrote a short story about a couple on a small farm in a remote part of Ireland. And I didn't know anything, whether it was a short story, whether it was rubbish. So I sent it to David Rice, who was running the School of Journalism in Rathmines at the time. And David and said to him, look, please don't spare me. If this is rubbish, tell me. And I'll put it in the waste paper basket. And he said, he was very good. He sent me back a short note and said, send it to Ireland's Own.
Okay.
I sent it to Ireland because it had a rural, and yes. It had a strong rural theme, and I sent it to Ireland's Own, and I didn't hear anything for ages. And then I was walking up the village in a little place where we had in West Wicklow, where we had a small bungalow during holidays, and a woman leant out her window and said, I've just read your story. And I
fame
I said,
at last.
I said, what? No, I said, what story? I had forgotten about it.
Of course.
And she said, in Ireland's Own. So it started from there.
See, you don't. Ireland's Own is a massive magazine.
Yes.
It goes to.
It's circulation.
It's huge.
Huge circulation. So it all started from there. Then I had a few short stories on RTE with Maxwell Sweeney.
Oh, yes.
Who long dead now. But,
yes.
But he broadcast a few of my short stories. And then I wrote a memoir.
About your time in...
About my life, really, and birth and so on.
I'm looking at a book here, and there's a picture of a cargo ship on the front.
Yes.
When did you decide that you were, instead of going cruising with karaoke competitions and knobbly knees and shuffling on board, did you decide that you would cruise on a cargo ship with your poor wife, Hillary? How did that, when you announced to her, by the way, Hillary, I love you, it's 1970, and we're going to head off on a cargo ship.
No, she was in on it in a big way.
All right.
It was a joint decision very much. I referred earlier, talking to you, going to Chicago for a year. Well, Hillary had a cousin who was a master in the headline out of Belfast.
A freight company.
Yes, a company of freight ships. And he said to us, why don't you go on one of our ships as a passenger? You've got plenty of time. And so... We did. And so we went from Liverpool across the Atlantic and down the St. Lawrence Seaway to Montreal and got a train then to Chicago. And that was it was a wonderful experience. There were
You were just 30 at that stage, so it was, the world was your oyster.
Yes. Yeah. And there were three other passengers and we had a great time. And it was just a wonderful experience. And we always said, we'll do it again. But then you get into...
Well, life takes over.
Exactly.
Children, the ministry and your job, and you start moving and start getting involved. So when did you pick it back up again? When did you just say to her, listen, I've missed those containers?
When we retired, we were then free, family reared, yeah. Gone, and job, no work particularly. So we booked on a cargo vessel to for 6 weeks, 5 weeks, I think, to the West Indies and South and Central America. And that was a wonderful experience. It was what they call a reefer, a refrigerated ship going out to the West Indies to bring back soft fruit, bananas mainly, and pineapples and so,
you,
on.
You left Dover, I'm just looking at the list in the book here, Antwerp, you went to Le Havre, then you went to the Azores, straight across the Atlantic into the West Indies.
Correct.
That sounds very glamorous, but on a, do you get to get off the cargo ship?
There were problems with this cargo ship. It had just come out of dry dock after a service, and it was due to go from Dover to Antwerp because they pick up the opposite of what furniture removers call a backload, you know.
Bring out a full boat and try and bring back a full boat to make a few bob.
But they were going out to bring back the fruit, so they brought out anything they could.
Yeah.
And so we had time in Antwerp. We had time in Le Havre. We had a whole day in Guadeloupe and another day in Martinique.
When you're on a cargo ship, I would imagine it's an uneventful experience in the sense there isn't a whole lot going on. But on that first voyage subsequent voyages, I mean, rough seas, emergencies, that sort of stuff.
Well, on that voyage, that was funnily enough, it was a voyage of events. The refrigeration unit packed up at one stage and we had to go back. We were in Central America, in Costa Rica, and we were a day sailing out and we had to turn back, and they had to fly out people from Europe to look after the thing.
And then there was a fire in an engine room, I believe.
Tell
us about the fire. you thought it was a drill.
I did, because they put us through a drill, you see, early on.
Yeah, for your muster stations.
We had just come up from lunch and the alarm thing went off. And Hilary had listened carefully at the drill, which I hadn't.
No.
And she listened and counted and she said, "That's muster stations." And she opened I opened the cabin door and there was an acrid smell of smoke in the alleyway. And we heard running up and down the alleyway. And so we put on our wetsuit and we headed for muster stations.
Okay.
And as far as we were concerned, for a good half an hour, we were likely... It was a beautiful day with a very
calm sea. I've got to interrupt you, Patrick, because did you go back to your cabin when you were told not to go back to
your
cabin?
Who told you?
And why did you do it?
Who told you that?
Well, you wrote it in your book. That's why I read your book. That's why you're here.
Yeah, I did. I did a very stupid thing, and Hilary let me know in no uncertain terms. I had been working, you see, writing most days, and I had a stick. And I thought as I came out of the cabin and headed for muster station. Now, I can do without everything I've left behind. And then I suddenly thought of the stick. And I went back and I got the stick, the computer stick, and Hilary had started to turn back to look for me at that stage.
But you lost her. I mean,
she was missing
it. Yeah, you see, you left that out. You left that you went back and you left that you lost Hilary. It was all tickety-boo up to that point.
Yeah, but eventually, anyway, we stood and waited at muster stations and the steward pointed out which lifeboat we would be in and so on. And then they finally got the fire
Frightening experience.
Well, they do it, you see, as soon as there's a fire because they can't be sure if they get it under control. It wasn't frightening, but it would have been frightening that night because there was a storm. If that had happened 12 hours later.
How many voyages in total have you done now?
Of those kind, two. Yeah. Into the Mediterranean we did one, where we had a lot of very good calls to port.
And you're heading off again soon, I'm sure.
Well, next year we'll certainly look seriously at it.
There's a text in here. It says, "I'm in County Leash putting the final touches to a church fundraiser for Ballinturbert Church for tomorrow night, the 1st of December. I'm delighted to have the Reverend Semple reading from his latest book."
That's
if
right.
If people want to buy your book about the voyages, about what you did on those voyages and your other books, how do they buy them?
It's a print-on-demand book.
Yeah,
which means it's not just on the shelves in bookshops, but bookshops will order it for you, no problem. It's on all the internet websites for books, Amazon and Smith and so on, or on my own website, patricksemple.ie. There's a contact email address and I can get it.
We'll put it up on our website as well. How about
that? The very thing.
Patrick, it's wonderful to meet you. I really enjoyed that chat. I'm sorry we haven't got longer. And as I say, if you want to buy the book, you can find it on patricksemple.ie. And for God's sake, when the fire alarm goes off in the lifeboats, leave your USB stick behind and get the hell out.
Exactly.
Patrick Semple, thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure and thank you.
We'll be back with music after this.
Text John on 51551.